First case on our calendar is 08-24-24, State of Ohio versus Sonix Williams. Ms. Ingram.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'd like to share 5 minutes of my time with amicus curiae, the Ohio Attorney General, and I'd like to save 2 minutes for rebuttal. There is nothing unconstitutional in the alternative commitment procedure the legislature created in Revised Code Section 294539C. That section applies to a narrow class of individuals, specifically among the universe of those who are mentally ill and subject to hospitalization by court order through the probate code. There is a specific subset to whom this applies, and that is those who not only qualify for commitment under the probate court, but who also have committed a violent felony for which they cannot stand trial because of their persistent and unrelieved mental incompetence. The statute satisfies due process because it requires clear and convincing proof not only of that person's status as a mentally ill person subject to hospitalization, but also clear and convincing evidence that they committed either
Counsel,
aggravated.
How is that determined that they committed the crime? What's the process that is utilized?
There is a hearing described in 294539 subsection C that says that the state, in order to do this commitment, the court must find by clear and convincing evidence that the person committed the crime charged. So it is a judicial finding based on clear and convincing evidence.
And how was that accomplished? Who presents evidence to the court of the guilt? And what is the response of this incompetent to that particular process within the process?
It's not at that point true proof of guilt. It's proof that the person committed the offense, because by the time it is moved to a point 39, guilt is not the object. It's proof that the person committed one of the specified violent acts. And when that is proved, if the state also proves that the person is currently subject to hospitalization under the civil standard, having already proved that they're presently incompetent and unlikely to be restored, then the court can exercise its jurisdiction and commit the person.
Then is there a mini trial within this process where the prosecutor then presents evidence as to the fact that the act was committed?
That's correct. And there was in this case.
So the victim testifies?
In this case, yes.
And what opportunity is there for the incompetent or his or her counsel during that hearing?
To cross-examine, the defendant has the full rights, that full adversarial rights, to test the state's evidence, to argue that the state didn't meet its burden, to undermine the testimony of any of the witnesses. It's an adversarial hearing. So the state is put to its proof, and the burden is on the state. So that at that point, this person is then subject to commitment. And the statute satisfies due process because we know, as I said, it's based on clear and convincing standard of proof, and the purpose of the commitment is tailored. I'm sorry, the nature and the duration of the commitment is tailored to its purpose. We know what its purpose is from 294539D1, which says the court shall impose the least restrictive alternative that is consistent with public safety and the individual's welfare, giving the balance for public safety, so that the purpose is public safety and the individual's welfare. We know that it doesn't violate equal protection, because while there are some differences.
Well, it's the person's welfare, but isn't it primarily for the safety of the community to place the person into a mental institution? Isn't that really to protect the community?
The statute says giving preference to the safety of the community. Right. But once the person is admitted, they have the same right to treatment as anyone who is admitted under 5122.
Well, is the at least for the first year, the objective is to restore to competency?
Before we get to the 39 commitment, the first year, up to a year, I should say, is to restore. If it appears that the person cannot be restored within a reasonable period of time, that's when, and it's only for those who have committed a list of violent felonies are eligible for commitment under under this alternative section.
And they're eligible for commitment up till the maximum amount of time that they would have been sentenced to had they gone through the regular trial and sentencing process, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's a backstop. The Constitution doesn't require any limit except—
I understand except, that, that's
but
not
that
my
is
point.
The backstop. That, right.
My point is, in the probate process, if the incompetent was remanded to the probate court, maybe remand is not the right word, but to the probate court for their involuntary commitment, there is no time limit.
That's correct.
There's just a review every 2 years.
Correct.
After the first 6 months.
Correct.
Or more often if requested, but a mandatory review in every 2 years. So to argue that the criminal proceeding is, I mean, I would think that you would, I don't understand how the process that's involved in point 39 is more, I guess, restrictive than the probate process.
It offers those who are committed thereunder a certain end date, which those committed under 5122 don't have. So in that respect, it does provide a benefit that it doesn't have to. There's no requirement that they be given a date certain under the Constitution.
Although,
on that
although,
point, go ahead. I was,
although at one point, if they have reached the maximum under the commitment under 39, there can be a petition by the prosecutor to then refer the case to probate court.
That's correct.
And the individual may be committed for a longer period. But doesn't the idea that the court is going to have periodic reports and bring the defendant back for a review of the situation, doesn't that also add to the due process argument?
Well, certainly, and that's one of the major differences, and that's why this case isn't at all like Jackson versus Indiana, where in that case the choice was when he was committed solely on the basis of a charge, and no reviews, no treatment, no nothing. He could have stayed there forever without a review, so that it does comport with due process in that way. I would also—
Ms. Ingram, before you get to your next point, one of the arguments that was advanced by the Court of Appeals was that the separate classifications in the Common Pleas Court and the probate create two categories of individuals with separate mechanisms for release. And they found that to be a denial of equal protection. What is your response to that suggestion that there are two categories and they're treated differently, though they're the same individual? In other words, when the court has the opportunity to commit an individual, they're both committed, or the individuals would be committed, but the release mechanisms are different. One comes back to the court, the other goes through a medical release, and the appellate court seemed to find that an equal protection argument.
Well, I have two responses. First, the differences aren't that significant. They have to do with the timing of the initial review, and the difference in treatment is that changes in conditions or an order of discharge has to come through the court, not simply through the chief clinical officer. It's an additional layer of supervision, but the differences aren't that. Once the person is committed, their treatment and their movement through the institution is driven by their medical needs and the safety of the community.
Should that then be a medical determination to be made as opposed to a judicial?
Medical determinations as to treatment, what kinds of therapy, what kind of medication.
But under 5122, it's medical release, is it not?
By the chief clinical officer. Here, though, this is my second point. They aren't similarly situated. Those who are committed solely under 5122 have shown a risk of harm in general.
Pardon me?
Present a risk of harm. The people who are committed under 294539 we've shown they've committed a violent act. So they're not similarly situated. They are more dangerous because they have proved they are more dangerous. So that the legislature built in an additional layer of review. So that if there's a recommendation for release or conditional release or discharge, the chief clinical officer can recommend it, but the court must decide it. It builds in an additional layer of accountability and responsibility, an additional set of eyes to view not only the welfare of the person being treated, but the the safety of the community. And in this case, it is justified by the fact that these people have actually committed a dangerous or a violent.
And so, counsel, the appellate court seems to draw a distinction between a civil commitment and a punitive criminal proceeding. And under the criminal statute, they look at it as though it is punishment. And because of the probate statute being in Chapter 51 and the commitment in the criminal section 29, they make a distinction based on that. What's your response?
I think that the court is just simply wrong because, well, first of all, let me say this. The amicus makes argues persuasively that distinction is actually beside the point in a due process. I'm going to argue that even so, it's obviously not punitive in nature. First of all, it is the conditions are tied exclusively to the purposes, which is treatment and safety. Second, the commitment absolutely ends when the person is no longer mentally ill and subject to hospitalization under the civil statute. Even if the person is not competent. In fact, the statute doesn't require any more attempts at restoration once they're committed under 3.9, so that as soon as the person is no longer subject to commitment under the civil statute, it ends. Third, the commitment is not the same as a confinement. Throughout the briefs and the opinion, those words are used interchangeably, but the fact is that very often, it's more, I don't want to undermine it, but it is a restriction of liberty. But oftentimes, these people are released into the community on conditional release. When they're hospitalized or under the commitment, they're with the population of other civil committees. It's not at all like jail. So that the purpose is obviously treatment. It's not a criminal statute masquerading as a civil commitment proceeding. And the clearest proof of that is that it ends when the person is no longer subject to hospitalization under the civil standard. If the court has no more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Ingram. Mr. Carney.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The Attorney General joined this case not just to defend a state statute, but because the mental health professionals, doctors, and others who administer the system know it's a civil system for treating patients and, yes, protecting the public, and it does not violate due process or equal protection. I want to stress just two quick points. On all of the due process issues here, this court under Burton and under Sullivan has always applied the bears no relation to the purpose test.
What is the purpose? Why a dual system? As I understand the way the statute works, the option of what the prosecutor to seek a civil commitment in probate court or a quasi-criminal, I guess you would call it. It's really a criminal commitment.
Your Honor, for several
comment,
reasons.
Please.
Just, first of all, in looking at the purpose, we have to look at why to have the commitment at all and then why to have it in common.
Well, we know
why
to have the commitment, but why two choices?
Right. Why to have it at all, though, is important and is at issue here because they claim under the Sullivan test, and the court below said this bears no relation to the purpose of restoring competency for trial. And once you acknowledge, we've given up on restoration here. We're not trying to do that. We're just having an open-ended commitment with periodic reviews to protect the public that no one doubts, if we did a reference over to the probate court, that there could be indefinite commitment and that satisfies due process. So that part of it about the purpose of the commitment under Sullivan is important, that it's about protecting the public. Then when you get to, but why is it in the common pleas court, that's really in the nature of the equal protection claim of saying, but I'm being treated different from other people subject to civil commitment. And it's important to keep the due process and the equal protection claims separate. Because when you look at equal protection, this court said in In re Burton, when it reviewed the 0.38, the different statute about the year for restoration, this court said there's only one standard in Ohio under 5122, and as long as the substantive standards are the same, or bad, in this case, even more advantageous to the person being committed, it doesn't matter that procedurally they're done by a common pleas court.
Whose choice?
It is the court's choice whether to continue jurisdiction or refer. Obviously, the parties can ask the court to go one way or another, but the court decides. And keep in mind, in a lot of counties, the probate court is the common pleas court. There's no constitutional right from U.S. Supreme Court cases that we have to put certain titles on our judges or courts. The real question is the process they use, because if we sent these all to probate but added these extra things for people who have been found to commit violent felonies by clear and convincing evidence, they'd probably have the same attacks. And on those substantive issues, the only difference is there's a higher standard for getting committed to begin with, which is in their favor, and there's a repeated standard of reviews to see if you're no longer subject to hospitalization. The only differences are, one, that your first report is after 90 days instead of 180 days. But coming off a whole commitment process and a whole year before it, that's a pretty minor procedural difference, especially in the different context. I see my time is up, so if I may just finish this answer.
I'd just like to hear those two points you were going to talk about.
Yes, and the other difference is who may release. And really, that's not that big a difference, and the small difference is justified, because under the probate court system, if a chief medical officer wants to release someone, they have to give 10 days advance notice before they do so to the court and prosecutor if someone had committed a crime and had it dismissed before the referral. That shows that so-called unilateral release isn't so unilateral, because you have to give a court a heads up in case they want to step in and do a fresh commitment. And so there's nothing about the common pleas court approving release that's problematic, especially when the accountability issue here is under the older system, and as the report that we cited.
How do you do a fresh commitment?
Well, a probate court can simply, if a chief clinical officer says we want to let someone out and they give a 10 days notice, the probate court can open a fresh case and say, we think you still meet all these standards, and the judicial determination would govern. And then they could send you to wherever the court thinks is the best location, which might not be the same place with the same chief medical officer.
Counsel, so couldn't they, in the alternative, just do an independent evaluation of that patient and have a hearing on that rather than, as you said, open a whole new case? And then
of course,
challenge
Your Honor.
It within the case that is already in process.
Correct. They can always do that. My point is, when I say fresh, in the sense of challenging, wait a minute, this so-called unilateral release isn't really going to happen. And there's no other purpose of that 10-day notice other than to second-guess that. And to the extent the criminal court does oversee it, keep in mind the accountability concern here is that the court hearing this case is charged with both protecting the defendant or committee's rights and also protecting the public.
Mr. Carney, let me ask you this. Isn't it likely that the reason for this statute is there was a fairly widespread feeling, right or wrong, that someone who evades criminal punishment for serious acts, murder, rape, those kinds of things, on the basis of mental illness, that there was a risk under the scheme that existed that a soft chief medical officer, psychiatric officer, would cut that person loose after a couple of years in an institution. And that the statute was enacted in response to that concern. That the legislature trusted judges to see to it that the person stayed in longer than chief medical officers.
Certainly, there was not just such a feeling, but as the report, there was a whole committee the legislature commissioned to have the lieutenant governor, prosecutors, and mental health professionals look at, because there were documented cases that are in the report that we cited that's online about how people who had been released did cause violent harm again. So it wasn't just a feeling or a fear, it was a reality that people caused harm.
Well, that's what I asked you a long time ago. Right.
But I wouldn't share maybe all the characterizations, but the point here is we are protecting the public. That is a permissible purpose, and for that reason, the court should reverse the decision below and uphold this system, because it both protects the public and the defendant or civil committee's rights at the same time.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. Mr. Cominell.
Chief Justices, good morning. May it please the court. The question before this court, Your Honors, is basically what may the government do and what they may they not do in the involuntary commitment of an individual who has been found to be incapable of being placed on trial. Furthermore, in the case of Thonix, as in the case of Roger Sullivan, it's not likely they're ever going to be restored. It's not likely that they're ever going to be retained competency. Since the United States Supreme Court in Backstrom and then Jackson versus Indiana, this court's adoption of those holdings through Burton versus Resuitado, Roger Sullivan's case, State versus Sullivan, the answer is very, very clear. And the answer is that the government, faced with an individual in this circumstance, may either release them, specifically stated in Sullivan, must dismiss the indictment, or they may institute customary procedures in a civil forum to involuntarily commit them, okay? I believe that to be the question. I believe the answer is clear based upon precedents of this court, and I firmly would argue that 2945.39 does neither of those.
Do you argue that the legislature does not have the permission or right under those cases to look at the issue of public safety? Because there is clear documentation that the civil commitment system does not take public safety into consideration in many instances. So why is that not a permissible constitutional goal?
First, Your Honor, under 50122, the danger to the individual themselves and the danger to others is a permissible, acceptable consideration for the
and
probate court.
There's very good statistical evidence that that is not being done by the civil commitment process.
The answer to your question is no. I don't argue that. What I do argue is that the precedent stands for the principle that based upon the accusation of a crime or even the actual commission of a crime, as in Backstrom way back in the 60s, the courts have said, this court and the United States Supreme Court, you can't treat them differently. You can't have procedures that are substantively different. That's the problem with 39.
And what is so substantively different? Because as I went through the comparison of the two, I mean, just the fact that it's in common pleas is not really very significant, because it's probate is a common pleas court. And as it was pointed out, many courts have one judge that does all functions. So that doesn't seem to be the difference. The only thing I can see that is really substantively different is the finding of clear and convincing they committed the act, which goes to the public safety issue that the civil commitment process does not give any weight to, or much weight to, even though they are supposedly should.
Okay. To begin with, I want to reiterate that the principle is, as announced in Jackson versus Indiana and this court in State versus Sullivan, is essentially that they must be afforded the same civil rights in an involuntary commitment, people in those situations, okay? I think you're asking specifically what's the difference. The government argues that there are differences. First of all, there's an agreement. If you look in all the briefs, everybody says, yes, there are differences. The government argues that those are inconsequential differences. Now, let me give you examples, which I think are the important ones. There's numerous ones. First of all, at the inception of institutionalization, under civil jurisdiction, the probate court, the judge is directed to place the individual in a facility or otherwise in accordance with the treatment needs of the patient. That's their direction. And they can consider danger to themselves and danger to others. The legislature in 5122 gives that judge a plethora of options that include the placement of the individual with another person. Quite literally, that could be their grandmother. That is the way the statute reads. Of course, we assume the probate court is well-reasoned and is going to make the appropriate choice among those choices. An individual like Thonix, who has been, they're arguing, civilly committed or substantially civilly committed, must be placed in a government-run facility, state of Ohio-run facility, in this case, the lockdown center, forensic center in Columbus. So, I ask on that point, is that an inconsequential difference, or is that a substantive difference between the way we treat individuals civilly committed and the way 39 treats them in a criminal commitment? I submit that grandma's house and a lockdown facility in Columbus are two very, very different things and very, very different means of treatment. Secondly, when it comes to the transfer of the
Counsel,
individual.
Counsel, just one yes. point. When you say that you're comparing your client, who admittedly committed a crime of violence, with a nonviolent mentally ill person through 5122, is that really a fair comparison? You're saying that there's a disparate treatment, but the overriding consideration here is that your client committed a crime. He's not going to be found guilty of that crime, but it's a crime of violence, and there's a victim. And that's different from someone who may be manic and needs some medication, and with medication and supervision can live with a family member. So you're kind of comparing apples and oranges here.
Respectfully, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because these are the mandates of the statute. These mandates, these differing substantive mandates, are exactly what is prevented by State versus Sullivan and by Jackson versus Indiana. You cannot have these differing standards. And they are not inconsequential, they are substantive. Now, I think I'd like to point out two things with respect to your question. First of all, presumption, not admittedly, that he committed a crime is what exists. The procedure by which he was found to have committed a crime, first of all, stripped him of all fundamental criminal defendant rights. I mean, we're talking about jurisprudence going back hundreds of years. He is incompetent. He cannot effectively assist in his defense. The statute suspends, in my opinion, the rules of evidence, certainly allows for hearsay evidence. The judge can read a police report. He doesn't have to have live testimony. There is no jury trial. And of course, that's troubling. But it becomes offensive when you consider the fact that this individual, Mr. Williams, as an incompetent defendant, is perhaps the weakest of all defendants presented to the court. And as the weakest, not only does the government strip him of all criminal procedural rights, they then lower the bar.
Does that not just point to the fact that this is a civil process and not a criminal process? If one facet, and that was, you know, if you remember, the crux of my initial questions to opposing counsel is this trial within a trial concept. But I'm not so sure that it is a trial within a trial. Merely, I mean, it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and there's no, as you said, jury. It's, which to me may be more indicative of the fact that this is a civil process and not a criminal.
Actually, I think it's demonstrative that it is a criminal, and the reason for that it goes back to the second part of how I wanted to answer your question with respect to the apples and oranges. The statute does not distinguish that, okay? So effectively, in Mr. Williams' case, he's accused of committing, I think, the most serious of crimes was rape, all right? A person who committed rape may be involuntarily committed through the civil statute, mm-hmm. without question. And that person is going to be afforded a differing standard of initial institutionalization, a differing standard of release, a differing standard of transfer. So the rationale that, well, he committed a crime is first of all prefaced on what I believe to be an unconstitutional procedure in making that determination. And secondly, not tied to everyone. And that is the problem, and that what I think the Second District said so clearly is, look, these civil statutes, such as the Hendricks case and other cases cited by appellate, they equally apply to people who are not charged with crimes, who have been convicted of crimes. This statute providing differing procedural standards for involuntary commitment only applies to individuals that are under indictment.
So, counsel, are you saying that point 39 totally should be ignored, and that if there is a situation involving, say, your client, that the only thing that could be done would be involuntary commitment under 5122? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think it's the only thing that could be done. I think it's the legislature's job to determine an appropriate vehicle by which this could be taken into consideration.
Well, how would that be then? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, under current law, the danger to others is a factor the probate court can take into consideration. How it would be, I've had a lot of time to think about this. I stood before this court and I argued on behalf of Roger Sullivan. And I argued that his rights were denied. And I am here now in the second half, as it were. The Attorney General argues that there was a well-reasoned, thought-out legislative intent on what was SB 285 back in 96. Well, that was based upon several high-profile cases. And if legislation based on several high-profile cases is not the epitome of reactionary, and I think we all know that reactionary...
So what is your goal here for your client? Is to have the indictment dismissed so he's not under the continuing jurisdiction of the criminal court, so that if he is restored to sanity, that then he's, you know, free to go as opposed to being held and brought to trial?
He may be reindicted if he's restored, whether he's under the probate jurisdiction or he's under the criminal
jurisdiction. But your goal is to have this indictment
with respect to this
go away if he is not able to be restored to competency within a year. Is that what the result of this would be?
I believe yes. I believe in the statement contained, I'll bet within a footnote, but nonetheless a statement of this court, that the court acknowledges the indictment must be dismissed under these circumstances, yes. I am asking that the criminal indictment be dismissed, and I am asking that Mr. Williams be probated. Mr. Williams needs to be an institution. I'm not here to ask for his release. Mr. Williams is mentally ill to the extent that he does not comprehend his surroundings, certainly doesn't comprehend basic principles of the legal system. And he is subject to institutionalization and does need that assistance. Nobody's trying to say or argue that he is not a danger to himself and perhaps others.
So
the problem is that there is this substantive difference of which, I'm sorry, did somebody ever, I thought I heard somebody speak, not only in the inception, but in the transfer, as demonstrated by the orders that I submitted in the appellee brief. There was a three-month delay in placing him in a less restrictive, more appropriate environment between the clinical recommendation and the order of the court. Now, you can have a person who committed rape, civilly probated, committed, convicted perhaps even, civilly probated, and you can have Thonix, who's never been convicted of anything, who stands only under indictment. And in order, the process by which a lesser restrictive facility is enacted, or their very release in the case of Thonix, who hasn't been convicted, is that the clinical director makes a recommendation, the closest forensic center reviews it, either agrees or does not agree. The government, through the prosecutor in a criminal case that could have been pending for years, is allowed then to object, and ultimately the trial court makes the decision. In the case of the individual who could have actually been convicted of rape but has been civilly probated, the decision for a lesser restrictive means or the decision to release is based simply upon the treating physician's determination and his written order.
But your objection then is really an equal protection argument, isn't it? You are drawing distinctions between two situations of what the statute and what 5122 talk about.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So it's equal protection.
I think the core of it is equal protection.
And if we find that those are separately situated situations, which can be treated separately, is that the end of your argument?
If you were to find that they were separately situated individuals, this court would have to overcome the fact that the statute does not apply equally to all. It applies to a very specific class of people under indictment, whereas in the Kansas case and the Hendricks case, I mean, this applied to convicted people, it applied to people accused, it applied to people that had served their sentences. I mean, there was clearly rationale to it. And part of the Second District's decision was, this is why it's criminal and this is why it's not rational, because at the end of the possible 10-year sentence, the individual is released, potentially still mentally ill and potentially still dangerous. So it really doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, on the one hand, the government says, look, he's not entitled to be afforded the same due process and procedural rights of any other criminal defendant, because it's civil in nature, and their second argument is he's not entitled to avail himself of the same substantive procedural rights as a civilly committed person because he committed a crime.
So, counsel, if someone appears in front of the court and is mentally incompetent, you would say under 38 they could be sent to the institution to be restored. I mean, you're not quarreling with point 38, right, for the 1 year of restoration. But if that doesn't happen, you are quarreling with point 39, and you would say if there is no restoration, either the indictment is dismissed and the individual is sent to probate. Is that kind of how you're coming at it?
Yes. State versus Sullivan, I believe, says the indictment is dismissed. Jackson versus Indiana and its progeny and the cases before this court says that the person must be afforded substantively the same rights as those civilly committed. And I firmly believe that the procedures are substantively different.
And it's 39 that you're really worried about as opposed to 38 and 40.
It is 39. And if I can have just, I think I've gone over, but just a second to answer this. The SB 285 in 1996, which was the core statute, had two fundamental changes to how we dealt with people that were incompetent. One was 38 and one was 39. 10 years ago, this court found 38 unconstitutional. It did not address 39 because Mr. Sullivan wasn't being held under the capacity of 39. While I did argue in the briefs what would eventually happen to Mr. Sullivan under 39 was unconstitutional, it wasn't a question before the court. Today, 10 years later, we have this question before the court.
Counsel, what impact, if any, does it have that under the 39 there is a time certain for release, or at least consideration for release, maximum sentence that could have been served? And under the probate system, under 5122, the only mandatory is a two-year periodic review, which could go on for 30 years.
First, under the probate system, there's a 30-day review. Every 30 days, they review their patients. While the mandatory court review is in line with the criminal statute. So there is more protection afforded the civil person with respect to the review, but it's in hospital. Secondly, there is, I believe, a confusion created by the government's argument in Jackson that somehow indefinite equates to permanent. It is not a question of permanent. It is a question of whether it's definitive or not. There is a definitive end to the criminal involuntary commitment. There was a definitive end in Jackson. In fact, one of the issues taken by the Supreme Court in Jackson was the clinical director in civil side in Indiana made the decision, whereas the court in the criminal side made the decision, which is exactly what 2945.39 does. So it's very similar. There were differences in the statute, but those were some similarities. When you're in an indefinite situation, I believe the case law says you must treat them equally. But indefinite does not mean permanent.
Counsel, I want to take you over even a little more. You, in the middle of your argument, said you've thought a long time about how could the legislature constitutionally address this concern that folks who have demonstrated that they are dangerous by committing serious and violent crimes, that the legislature is uncomfortable that the release decision can be made by a medical officer. What do you think they could do that would be constitutional? Would it have to all be in the probate? Are you saying you can't have these two tracks, but you could have under the probate commitment a different scenario for confinement, commitment, and release for those who have demonstrated by clear and convincing evidence that they are a danger to society?
I think there is a way to mold this into a constitutionally acceptable statute. Okay, I don't think the statute before the court is, but I think there is a way. Now, first of all, 5122 does already recognize danger to others. I think in some sense, and I don't think there's any other way to say it, I think the statute reflects some distrust in the probate court and the probate court's ability to place people in the proper circumstances. Again, the commission of a crime has not been found against my client, is not admitted, and was done in a hearing in which he had no rights, and his standard of challenging the evidence was tremendously lower. So a clear and convincing standard of commission. We have clear and convincing standards. The probate court can take all of that into consideration in reports, which include police reports, for proper placement. If the legislature wanted to raise the bar for civil commitment to equalize it with criminal commitment, I would be merely speculating. I have to look at what they did and how they did it, because I think that's what you're asking. If we equalize it, would it be okay? It might be. However, it might still end up offending the principles of State versus Sullivan, Burton versus Rushital, and Jackson versus Andy. I don't know unless the statute would be.
But the problem has not been in the probate court and its commitment. The problem has been in what happens afterwards in the medical system, where they're released, where they, you know, they may be released within 2 weeks. They may be released very soon. They don't look at the seriousness of the crime committed. They look at whether they're restored to competency.
I think there may be cases, in fact, I'm certain that there are, Your Honor, where that is, in fact, the case. The problem goes back to, we have a statute that has enacted mandatory differing standards of treatment as against precedents of this court. The solution to that is the legislature's. I'm before the court asking the court to declare the statute unconstitutional, which I believe effectively will send the legislature back to try a new approach, as they had to do with subsection 38. The solution is not necessarily the responsibility of the court,
Were you involved at all in the legislative process to make this current fix after our last decision?
Not at all. In fact, in the Attorney General's brief, and I believe on bail, you can see the makeup of the committees, there were no defense-oriented individuals, such as the Public Defender's Office or whatnot, involved in the drafting of these statutes.
You've used your time, Mr. Cumino.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
Ms. Ingram, we've taken you past your time, but you may take 30 seconds for rebuttal.
It's not accurate to say that at the 39 hearing he had no rights. In fact, he had all the rights afforded to a person who would at a 5122 hearing. That statute specifically says that it provides all of those rights unless they're clearly inapplicable, so that he did have those. And that prevents that little hearing from being a trial within a trial. There's rules of civil procedure applied, and he was given substantive rights. To argue, the heart of the court's opinion is found in page 62. They believe that Backstrom and Jackson and Williams argues requires that all people committed civilly must be treated identically. And those cases don't hold that. That's a false choice. In that case, there was no other alternative. For these reasons, I'm asking the court to reverse the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ingram. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.